Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Australian
Survivor.
21 South Africans, 12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
Give them the swimmer.
£1 million.
Million
euro.
Million.
The adventure of a lifetime.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to RHAP's coverage of Survivor South Africa. I'm your host, Shannon Gates, here for a very, very special interview, something that I think we're very, very privileged to be able to do, something we've been trying to make happen for a while, and it is going to be a good one. But before we start, firstly, please welcome my amazing co-host who pointed out to me today that we have done a Survivor South Africa podcast every month since May, the great Mike Bloom.
Yes, Shannon, I'm going to be uncharacteristic and start off with a sports reference, but we have a real Nolan Ryan-esque streak of making sure we do at least one Survivor South Africa podcast per month. We only have 1 month left of 2019 and of the decade in general. Let's see if we can find an excuse for a nice holiday treat. But I think Christmas came early in the form of our guest today.
Yes, we are super, super lucky, as I've said. So without further ado, please do welcome the amazing host of Survivor South Africa, the great Nico Panaggio. Nico, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, what an intro. The great. Nico Panaggio. I'm going to put that on a plaque and I'm going to put it on my wall. Thank you so much, Shannon. Hey, Mike, so good to be with all of you and to be jumping in on this incredible platform that you guys have created.
Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit offline, but I know that Nico, you know, you've been able to listen to a few of our podcasts. I will say it is truly surreal to have a host of a Survivor season be able to say that, but for you to have be able to take the time, given your very busy schedule, I'm sure, to come on and speak with us about, you know, obviously your involvement with Survivor thus far. I can't wait to get into it, but I mean, first and foremost, we have to thank you for coming on and doing this, because this is just an awesome opportunity.
No, listen, I've got to say, our series producer LaRue told me, he said, "I mean, have you heard to their podcast?" And I'm like, "No, I'd love to." I mean, you know, it's always interesting to hear how people unpack things, especially when you guys started unpacking Survivor SA. You know, one wants to hear what gets said, and you know, one goes in there with a bit of curiosity at first, and then after a while, you're hooked on just the the various permutations of the game that you guys pull out of the hat. I mean, the perspectives that you the insight that you have into it, and it's always as I was saying offline, it's so enlightening to listen to what other people think and how you see it, and then also it informs us as we go forward and the things we think about. And you're a great voice, I think, for the viewers out there and of course, for the fans as well. So it's great to have your perspective that really it covers so much. So I'm quite stoked to be on the platform today.
Thank you so much. Like, that is an incredible thing to hear that, like, we could inform what you do. But even just so to have you and LaRue, who are so tapped into, like, not only the podcast, but, like, the fandom in general and really, like, connecting to the fans in that way and being so interested in what, you know, fans like us or any fans might be saying is, I think, why Survivor South Africa has been such a quality product. Like, that is an incredible thing, I think, for any franchise of Survivor.
Yeah, I think, you know, from the get-go, I mean, we've all South Africans have been fans of the format since the first US episode hit our shores years ago, and later being able to do it ourselves was obviously a huge honor. But I think one thing we always realized was that one had to do justice to the show at the very, very highest level. There was much of that as one could possibly do, and to do so, you'd need to know what the audience wants and what the audience expects from the show. It's such a phenomenon, isn't it? The show Survivor, and the fact that it exists to this day on so many different in so many different territories in so many different ways, but quite true to the original format, you know. And that's quite a testament to what a solid format it is.
Well, before we get into the Survivor of it all, I mean, I want to look a little bit into your background, because I simply have to ask, Nico. How does a soap opera star become a host of Survivor? What was that transitional period like for you personally, and how did it sort of happen behind the scenes?
Well, it's interesting. You know, people always ask, because I studied drama. I'm actually I studied to become an actor. I've always loved it. I think I was in my first play in the theater in the state theater when I was nine or 10 years old, and that's where the bug bit. So I've always been into acting and into drama, and then in later years, you know, I think the two kind of go hand in hand, because in South Africa you need to diversify your skills, because especially, you know, two decades back when I started in the industry, it was a very small industry, and in fact we didn't really have much film, we didn't have much series, so we really, soap was the only thing we had going for us. In fact, I think at one point we had more soaps going in South Africa than the entire United States. So being a soap star was kind of what you did if you wanted to, you know, to be an actor on screen anyway. And that was quite a while ago. And so part and parcel to that was going out and hosting events, hosting live events, you know, those kind of went hand in hand, what we call emceeing here, or master of ceremonies, or public speaking. So that kind of was an extension of being on a soap, a national soap, and that had quite a demand for, you know, the physical presence of the actors at events and to host events and to MC events, facilitate that kind of thing. So I kind of segued into that very quickly, which became part of what you do. And also, I'm going to be straight up with you, you know, in our industry, you want to bolster to your income as much as you can, because we don't get paid exorbitant amounts of money as do other hosts of other shows. We won't mention names. So the point of the matter is you kind of diversify your skills and learn a lot of different ways of just going about capitalizing on whatever it is, whatever platform you're on. And so for me, it started with soap, a so-called Sevendalon or Seventh Avenue many years ago. It was quite a popular soap at that stage, and so I was lucky to land once a year they have auditions, or once every quarter they have an audition, you know, just an open audition to see, open casting to see who, you know, who's out there, what talents are there. And I came and I did a casting, and I was very lucky that they wrote a character for me, and this character was of course a half Greek, half Afrikaans guy, which was what I was. And so they wrote me into the soap, and then I ended up staying there for 5 years. And it was during that time that the first Survivor SA episode or season was what they were casting for in South Africa. And when I heard that, I mean, I'd already been a fan of the US season for a number of years. And so when I heard that, I was like, I was the first one to enter, I think. I mean, I'd been waiting for this moment for a long time. So, I can keep going with that story, Mark. Did you want to say anything else? Shannon, did you?
No, I just can't believe that you... So you applied to be on Survivor for the first season, and then by season three, we're hosting it. Like, that must have been quite a journey.
Yeah, that seems to be the thing, then, because LaRue also applied to be on Survivor and then became it. But that speaks to, you know, what we were speaking about earlier, where, yeah. I mean, I think it is really interesting how this show is almost run by people who had so much interest and love for the game that they wanted to be contestants even before they became involved. You know, to them, yeah. And Nico, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like it's not just another job. You know, this is something that you are truly invested in.
Oh, definitely not. You know, I think I've been very blessed to be the host on a number of interesting shows in South Africa. And as I say, you have to diversify your skills. So you end up in, you know, the very thing that's the adversity in that there's not, you have to diversify. You don't get paid a lot for doing just one job, means that you have to kind of explore other avenues of and of your own talent, you know, and so you've got to find ways to kind of maximize that. So I delved into all kinds of things. And of course, then you find things that you enjoy and you want to do. And so I hosted a travel show and a magazine show as well, which I loved and really enjoyed doing. But I mean, when Survivor came around, I mean, that is, it doesn't get more iconic than that. And just to, I mean, just to enter and try and get onto it, I think most, you know, red-blooded males and females just wanted to get on Survivor. I mean, you know, it's quite funny. We all imagine those slow-mo shots. You know, that's what you see, is that, you know, that hyper-saturated slow-mo shot, you know, that intro of Survivor, and everyone sees, you know, that's what you think it's about, you know, these hero moments. You don't have a clue what it's about. So you don't care. You just want to get in the show. It's so, like, it's so raw and gritty, you know, and you don't even think about what would go into that. So you immediately, I mean, back then, everyone who thought of Survivor in South Africa, we thought of Survivor as this great adventure show, you know. It's this amazing adventure, this opportunity. So, and I'm always up for adventure. I love it. I love being outside. I just love that. So I thought, okay, great. And I entered, and I think we had to come up with one item that we'd take to the island with us, you know, and do like a little thing. We didn't do video entries back then. It was like a physical entry. People stood in queues. And I don't think the queues for those first ones were very big either, because people didn't really kind of grasp it just then. But I remember I took a Swiss Army knife and I fashioned it into, I had everything in there. I had a toothbrush on one of the arms, and I had sunscreen lotion taped to the other arm. And then I had a few pages of my Bible, you know, some of the key pages that was taped on one arm. And I had a lighter, you know, not a flint, a lighter tape. So this was my one item, you know. I thought I was being clever, mm-hmm. but somehow it managed to get through the first few rounds. And then the answer came back, you know. I think I made it to like top 30, and then the answer came back, and they were saying, okay, well, listen, and I was on Seven Delan at the time, the soap, and they came back and they said, listen, you've done really well. We've gotten to the last rounds, but we've decided we're not going to use any known faces in this season. We wanted to be people who don't have any kind of public background, because, you know, otherwise it might be an advantage. I mean, how on earth could it be? But anyway, that's what they told me. Maybe it was a story to let me down easy. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, it was the first time in my life that I was too famous for something. Mm-hmm. And
double-edged, you know, army knife, really.
Yeah, exactly. Or toothbrush / sunscreen.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, the long and the short of it is I would have loved to get on there, you know. And then the second season came around, and I was caught up in a contract I couldn't enter. And then the third season, I actually got a call from one of my colleagues at the soap, who'd known me and was involved with someone who knew someone, and they were looking for me. They were looking for me because they tried to contact my agent and ask them if I would please read for, you know, they're casting a new host for Survivor, and if I'd please read for it, but no one's getting back to me. And eventually someone called me and said, listen, these guys are trying to get hold of you. Are you interested at all? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And so I found out that somehow, we won't talk about who the agent was, but somehow it slipped through the cracks. And if I hadn't received that call from a friend, I wouldn't have gone to the audition. Needless to say, wow. I hopped on a plane from Cape Town and flew to Johannesburg, went to the audition, you know, quite nervous for the first time to audition for anything, because I've been casting for years on different things. So you don't really get so nervous anymore. You kind of, you know, you kind of use that energy. And I remember I got on the plane and I was sitting on the plane. I was speaking to my wife before we took off, and I said to her, that is the worst audition I've ever done. It's the worst casting. I mean, I duffed it. I think I was just too nervous because I wanted it so badly, you know, and I'm not used to being nervous at a casting. And of course, the following day I got the phone call, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was just surreal to me. I mean, think about it. Someone calls you and says, you've been selected to be the host of Survivor. I mean, that is something one only dreams about. And so I still enjoy that memory.
Amazing. So, I mean, I think about that all the time.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, I'm so intrigued about this audition, though, because, you know, what we sort of experienced from the hosting perspective, and one of the many reasons we're so glad to talk to you, is Jeff obviously has a very different story. Obviously, Survivor was built, like, through him. He has been with the show since the very beginning, as opposed to you, who, like you said, Survivor was sort of an institution by the time the South African version started. So what was the host audition like? Did you just walk in with your Swiss Army knife and you were like, hey, remember me? I'm back and I'm ready for more.
No, Mike, I left the Swiss Army knife back home. They wouldn't let me on the plane with it. But, but I did take my toothbrush. No, you know, it was literally, I think it was, there's this behind the studios where they were filming it. There's this rocky outcrop in Johannesburg. It's called Lone Hill. And they went to, it's the most survivory looking kind of backdrop I think they could find close to studios in a major city, away from any kind of tropical island. And so it was like this really kind of, you know, I had this linen Guess brown khaki shirt that I had in my cupboard that one of my daily items that I wear, you know, and I took that along. It was the most survivory kind of thing, and I wore that, and I can't even remember if I had a cap on, but I do remember that we had to kind of host various versions of, you know, an episode of Survivor. You know, we had to do a bit of a challenge explanation, and then we had to do a bit of a commentary on a challenge, and then we had to do a bit of a tribal council. So I think I love chatting, and I love interviewing people. So I think maybe that part came a lot easier to me. But you know, when you're in the audition, and in the casting, all you feel is your heart beating, and you don't really have an idea of what you're coming across like. And so you have no idea when you walk out of there whether you did well. And usually you just leave it and walk away and go, you know what, if I get it, I do, and if I don't, I don't. And then you hope for a call, and usually you forget about it. But Survivor is not something you just forget about. So it's stayed on my mind for a couple of days until I got the call.
That's absolutely incredible. I mean, to finally get on as a host when you'd been applying as a contestant must have been crazy. I mean, you've referenced it, and LaRue referenced it, you really were a fan of the US show. Did you bring a lot of that, like, to the audition? Did they know that this was something that you were really passionate about?
I'm trying to remember whether or not that even came up. As I say, it was such a tense, I think, casting for me. I can't even remember what I said most of the time. I think I just went into natural mode and just let it flow. And it's one of those situations where afterwards you think, what the frick did I say? Did I say the right things? You know, and perhaps that maybe is what clinched it for me, is that I didn't bring anything but me, just very highly energized. And maybe that's what worked, you know, because when you're hosting, when you're presenting, it's something you learn later, is that you've got to be yourself. Because to be someone else for an elongated period of time, it's just never going to play out. It's not going to be sincere. So you got to be yourself on a lot of coffee. And I think that's kind of where it went, and still be articulate and connect. I think that's kind of what was happening organically with me anyways, you know. The rest is history.
So some people might not know this, especially those that are newer to the series. But as you spoke about, you were not the first host of Survivor South Africa. So you find out, you got this amazing gig. You're going out to Mozambique for season 3. I mean, did you contact Mark Bailey at all? Or was there anything you tried to sort of like mimic from his performance from the first couple seasons? Or to your point, were you more so like, this is Nico's time, I'm going to host it the way I want to host it?
Yes, I think, Mike, you've pegged it, because you know, when you're coming into something like this, if you're, like I said, if you're trying to emulate anyone, you're going to run into trouble, because that can only go so far. And you'd probably not do a great job of emulating people that have done a great job of being themselves before. So my rule of thumb with presenting has always been to do it my way. But what was great, and this is really a testament to Mark's character, is because when the third season came along, he was already contracted out to other things, because we had gaps between our seasons. because we didn't do back-to-backs and we didn't do them annually. So, you know, you could find yourself locked down in another contract when the new season comes around. And that's what happened to Mark. And so that was a blessing to me. And you'd imagine, you know, it would make it, because I would imagine he would have loved to carry on with Survivor, but he was locked into this contract. And the first thing he did was contact me and say, listen, I'd love to sit down with you for a coffee and just, you know, give you my 5 cents worth and you can do and take with that. I want to see you succeed at this and good luck. You know, and we had a coffee and I asked him a bunch of questions about what it was about. And I really enjoyed that about him. He's such a great guy. And testament again, once to him, because I mean, he has a guy who had no training whatsoever in presenting and he came in and did the first two seasons of Survivor. And I always tell people I use everything that I've ever learned when it comes to Survivor, because it is such a fast-paced show. It's almost a live show throughout. And you have very little time to fix anything or to redo things. You've really got to be in it and on it all the time. And a lot, I think what makes the show work is the organic nature of it. And if you're not an organic presenter, it's going to be very difficult. And so here comes Mark, and he got thrust into all of that and into a high-profile show, which he had to deliver on. And I think he did a great job. But to the second part of your question is coming into a show that let's take Jeff, for example. I mean, let's be honest. I think Jeff is the one who put the show on the map, you know, and he's a legend. I mean, we all look up to him. I think he's such an incredible host and he is the face and he set the bar for us all, you know, he's the one whose footsteps we follow in. But, I think my mandate for myself was to go in there and to be myself within the parameters of the format and also of what Jeff has already kind of set as jargon for the show. There was a lot of things that one I could change and I could mess around and I could do differently, but there were certain things that just felt right to do the same and to kind of follow in Jeff's footsteps in terms of Jeffersons even, you know, there's certain things that it just, you know, when I tried anything else, it just didn't feel right. For example, silly little things like when, you know, when the tribes come on, you know, when they're walking towards you for a challenge and you say, come on in guys, you know, to say anything else just didn't feel right. You know? And so we kind of, there were certain things we wanted to stick with, but there's so much else and so many other ways in which one can just be yourself. And I think, I tried really to concentrate on what I wanted to do with it and within the parameters that had already been set.
And was there anything else that you did from a prep perspective, you know, other than like getting that coffee and kind of listening to those insights? Did you do mm-hmm. other stuff to prepare?
Do you mean for each season or, you know, from my first season?
Yeah, I think from the get-go, but definitely like in the ways you evolve as well.
Yes, I mean, you know, it's so daunting that first season because you've got these huge, huge shoes to fill in the form of Jeff Probst and then others around the world, and you don't know what to expect. You don't know how good or bad you're going to be. You don't know, and also, I mean, think about the crew as well. Think about the from the producer's perspective. They don't know how this person. I mean, you may have done okay in the audition, but you know the amount of pressure. In the game when we're shooting, there is so much going on every single day for 39 days absolutely while we're shooting, but even the preamble to that, there's so much prep work that goes into every single day. There's very little time for anyone to be to be dragged or to be coddled. You know, everyone knows what they're doing, and you've got to hit the ground running in the show as a contestant and of course behind the scenes as crew and of course me as the host. So I did everything I could. I mean, I watched as many seasons of the US version that I could watch them over and over again in terms of trying to understand the format and make sure that I understand how things work. Because once again, it's not a scripted show. It seems that way, but it's not really a scripted show. You go in there with a structure and then you let it unfold organically. There's lots of interesting stuff that happens. I remember we were in I think it was Mozambique that was the first one I did in a paradise island, Mozambique, and Survivor Santa Carolina, I think we called it. And I remember arriving on set and our director Donald was taking me around. He was showing me around and showing me, okay, this is where the island is going to be. And I was doing a whole recce with them, you know, and I was just blown away being on set, you know. And I remember at one point I turned to Donald and said, so where are the, you know, the port-a-loos? Where are the toilets, you know, where are the for them to use? He's like, what do you mean? I said, well, should he? I mean, they don't really, you know, he's like, they don't even get a spade.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even, if they're lucky, they get a spade. I was like, oh, she, so it's that real? And I think that's when the realization set in that it is so real, you know, and the reason that it's so raw and real is because that's how we shoot it. These people are really hungry. They are really, really desperate. They are really, really dirty and uncomfortable and all of those interesting things. And that all goes into making such an incredible show because you really are putting people into a situation where they are stripped of all those comforts. And then, of course, true character comes to the fore, and we can unpack that a bit later. But what it did for me was tell me, okay, well, organic and real is the only way that's going to work in any way to host the show and to be sincere about it. You've kind of got to flow with it. And I think in terms of prep, Shannon, as you asked, I think that's what I did is I tried to know what it was about so that going in, I could then be comfortable to be me. And again, within those parameters.
And I can imagine that you were immediately relieved to find out that you would be able to use porta potties, just not the contestants, I'm sure.
Well, no. You see, what most people don't know, Mike and Shane, what people don't know, and this is quite a revelation, I think, for, because, you know, I know how Jeff and the others do it. But, you know, in South Africa, we're a bit more real and manly about things, you know. So what happens is they fly me in a couple of weeks before the contestants get there. But we don't land because it's like a customs issue. So I skydive in alone with a backpack and a knapsack. And then I build my own shelter and stuff and just get the lay of the land, get the feel of things, smell the earth, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, no one ever believes that story.
So I'm so intrigued to find out, you know, your role behind the scenes as well as in front of the camera. Because again, seeing things through the Jeff Probst perspective, we know how much he's involved with, you know, finding out things behind the scenes, helping craft exactly how a season works. But also he plays a very large role as now, you know, executive producer and co-showrunner. So from your perspective in between, I guess, where you started and where you are now, you know, how much are you finding out behind the scenes? And when it comes to that preparation process, as we spoke about with LaRue, how much are you involved in that?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think, you know, in the first few seasons, you're just the host, you know, so you kind of you're always watching from you know, over a shoulder, and you're taking in as much as you can, soaking it all in, not knowing what information is going to be pertinent, what information is going to be useful, and so you just take it all in, and it's almost a, I suppose you get, you know, just overstimulated with all kinds of things. There's just so much to take in. And initially it's quite daunting, but, it was just something that one had to do to kind of try and stay ahead. And then as one progresses in seasons, you start realizing, well, this is where I want to spend more time. That's where I want to spend more time. And so I could kind of decide what I wanted to, you know, where I wanted to be involved with. And of course, working with Henry and LaRue, we've eventually developed this uncanny ability to just communicate without doing so verbally, you know, and just to understand it. And Henry and I work very closely together. So as the seasons progressed, I got more and more involved, and we have debriefs every day. You know, that I would go and sit after a long day in the sun and in front of cameras. You'd go and sit in these. I think LaRue mentioned it, in these long debriefs, and often I would literally be standing and falling asleep while I'm listening to the content directors debrief, you know, and give us the lowdown of what happened. And you almost miss some of the nuggets. And so what we did was eventually we streamlined that as well. So I would get a really a more streamlined debrief of pertinent things and things that happened, beat by beat moments. And so I'm involved from an information perspective with as much as possible, but I'm not involved with things that don't concern me. You know, so whereas completely different, I would imagine, with Jeff, because he's, you know, he's an EP, and so he's got to be involved with everything. And I'm not sure to what degree he does, but I marvel at that because I'm already incredibly busy just as a host. So I marvel at the fact that he's able to do that as well. But you know, he's been doing it for 40 seasons now, going into that. So I think he does it in his sleep. but he's a remarkable human being, and we all know that he really is a legend in every way. So I think I think it's. It, I mean, I'd love to be to be there in 5 or 10 seasons' time, where I'm involved in that to that level, because I really enjoy it. But you know, that said, Henry and LaRue as well. They, I mean, they've included me in everything because they know how important it is to have just an innate understanding and an organic understanding of what's going on. And we can't preempt what information is important. We don't know what we're going to need and what we're not going to need. We prep as much as we can, and then we let it play out organically. So as much as you can put into it, you put into it, and then when we hit record and you know they come walking in, everything plays out, and we've got to go with what we've got. You know, so as much info as I can get, it's just that much better. But we also we balance it because there's only so much you can take in. Whereas I would imagine. Again, Jeff must be involved on so many different levels, but I'm pretty sure he also delegates and keeps himself focused on the very important and integral parts.
I mean, I would think that there's some production stuff just behind hosting, because as you said, it's so involved. Like, for example, Tribal Council, I'd love to get your approach to that, because you're someone who has to get answers out of the contestants, but you don't want to tip them off too much. Like, it's really a bit of a balance. And in any question you ask, you're making a production decision about what's getting discussed, what the contestants know, what basically is like the issue on the table. So how do you approach that and kind of strike that delicate balance in something like Tribal Council?
Yeah. And once again, it's so important to remember that there's very little that we can script or preempt, you know, because everything is changing on a moment-to-moment basis. So especially prior to Tribal Council, there is so much going on that beach, even on the walk up to, before we put them in a gag order. I don't know if you know the term gag order. We only let them speak when they've got cameras on them. So whatever you see is, you know, we try and keep everything for camera, and that's also why the show works so well. But so everything that up until the last moment before they get gagged, you know, things change at that last moment. Someone says something to someone else, and so we try and stay on top of that. But there's very little one can do to preempt what's going to happen, and so you really you try and get as much as you can in, and then you kind of flow with it. So. In terms of prepping for a Tribal Council, we kind of have an idea where we want to go. So to kind of to lay it out for you, we'd prior to Tribal Council, a couple of hours prior to that, myself and Henry will get together, and we will kind of Henry will give me the lowdown on what's been going on, what the main story beats are, what we're looking at, what's happening, and we'll discuss where we think it might go, and then we'll build a structure for Tribal. You know, we want to start with some questions about island life and how everyone's, you know, dealing with, you know, adapting to the game, the discomforts and that. And then slowly but surely we'll get into the more, you know, the more important stuff, you know, the how people are feeling, who's rubbing who up the wrong way. And then along the way, as we go into these different segments, I'm constantly watching, because, you know, and here's the thing about Tribal is it's such a it's the part I think I love the most, because you've got to be so switched on to even someone lifting their eyebrow is information right. For me. So I've got to play this very careful game. I've got information in my head. So every question I ask, every thought I have to screen through whether or not I'm able to let this information out. Because essentially the role of the host is to be the facilitator. I can't take sides. I have to be completely unbiased. I have to treat everyone equally. I have to, you know, make sure that the rules are obeyed, and I have to facilitate. And I have to also ask people questions at Tribal. And the way I approach Tribal is I want to give every person sitting in front of me in that tribe an equal opportunity at saving themselves tonight, because, you know, barring what's played out and plans that are made, things can change very quickly at Tribal. So especially those who are on the block, but even those who don't, you know, who at the moment feel safe, I want everyone to know that this is your last chance. So have you looked at every possible opportunity to further yourself in this game? And I mean, that goes for those who are in the game and those who are about to go home tonight. And so it's very important for me to keep an eye on what I say and how I say it, so I don't give anything away. But I've also got to dig in there, and every opportunity they give me at Insight, because they come there with such poker faces. I mean, they come in there and they are adamant that they're not going to let anything out. There is no way I'm going to get the better of them. They're not going to give me any information they don't want to. And then everyone leaves having said more than they wanted to, you know, and that's the beauty of tribal. You know, you're lulled into this, you're sitting around a nice hot fire, you know, and we're chatting. And obviously it's quite tense because someone's going home and there's a lot of emotional tension and that, but people, you know, are listening to other people and they're listening to things that they've never actually, or not haven't necessarily heard some of their tribe mates say, because they don't always articulate what they're thinking and feeling around their camps. So tribal council is also a way of hearing what other people are thinking that you aren't even allowed to speak to. We often have cases, you know, obviously between alliances, that if you walk over and go and talk to them, you're immediately a suspicious person, and then your alliance looks at you, you know, in a different way. So people are scared to actually say things, and then a tribal that comes out. So immediately that informs everyone sitting there. So it's interesting to kind of sit there and watch how people try and keep it back. I've got to dance around them. They're dancing around my questions, and then we slowly start finding, you know, those cracks, and we go in there, and I know where not to go too deep and where to leave back. And but it's quite precarious, isn't it? It's quite a precarious situation to be in. So one goes in there fully switched on. I really, really just almost meditate before tribal. I stand there and I just really quieten myself and really, when I sit down, do my best to just be focused intently on what's going down. And you've got to listen to the person speaking. And then possibly the more important information is the reactions on the faces behind them and on their side, you know, and that's quite interesting. And then you've got some people in your head calling cues and all kinds of things. You've got peripheral things happening around set. So it's possibly where I need to concentrate the hardest.
So another element that gets added in, you know, about halfway through the game is this jury. You know, here are another thing you need to control, this gaggle of eliminated contestants who, especially in the case of Survivor South Africa, and especially the case in the past couple seasons, are certainly observing and occasionally commenting on what's going on. And, you know, you speak about you not wanting to give, you know, show your hand as much in terms of, you know, what's going on behind the scenes or how people are feeling about what's happening. I can imagine that when you have these rogue elements of people next to you, you know, sometimes being a little too maybe overreactionary to what's happening in the game, that can be a little bit of trouble. And we've heard a couple times, especially this past couple seasons, about, you know, attempts to try to keep this jury a bit under control from their reaction. What's been your experience with trying to control that element, especially as of late when we've had some very emotional people on the jury?
We certainly have. Oh, my word, I'll tell you. Listen, that's the difference, isn't it? That they're still part of the game, even though they're the jury and they're not in the game, they're still part of the game. And they have the ability to be able to react in any which way they want to. I obviously can't. I've got a, you know, how I feel is immaterial. And so, for me, I think it's great having a jury that's reacting, because it also kind of ups the tension to those that are still left in the tribe. You know, as the numbers dwindle, the ones who are left there are the ones who you know, they've played the game in such a way that they're still there. They've risked life and limb to be still sitting there. They've broken friendships with people who are now on the jury. Obviously, there's going to be an emotional impact on the jury members. And often, you know, our contestants that are left, our castaways that are left, when the jury starts building up, they forget about the jury. They almost discount the jury. And it's very important that they don't do so, of course, because they play a huge part in the end. And I think what was very prevalent this last season is that the jury made sure you didn't forget they were there. I mean, it was hard to ignore at times. And I want to say, isn't it kudos to Nicole? Because, I mean, she was sitting there. She was being lambasted, you know, in terms of expressions every single time. And she was just soaking it in. I'd love to sit down with her and find out exactly where she went to in terms of just being able to keep it all together when you know, a lot of that was playing out. But also, you know, as you say, it's such a fine line. I think yes, certainly there is a place where the jury needs to be stopped, because they, as much as they, you know, can react, they've got no input into the game anymore except until that last vote. And they've kind of got to respect their place, don't they? I think there's a lot of emotion on the jury as well. They're so angry at themselves. You know, when they're sitting there, can you imagine in your face every day You're sitting at that jury every other night, and you're looking at these people who stayed. They're people that you want to grab around the neck and throttle, or you know, at the very least, kick a spark from the fire into their eye. Just something small, you know, nothing damaging. And there you sit, and they're still there, and you hear, and you know that you're actually the one who made a mistake, or that you just weren't aware enough, you know, and whatever else plays out in their minds. So I can imagine how frustrating it is for them. And in that moment, they're still highly emotional. You know, back at Ponderosa, they're discussing things amongst themselves. So I don't think one can control a jury like that, and especially not a South African one.
And now a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. Yeah, well, like, speaking of the contestants, I feel like your relationship with them must be so unique. Like, you're this kind of impartial person to them, or hopefully impartial, but you're watching them go through this thing and, you know, probably forming relationships with them. Like, how do you view your relationship to the contestants in the game? Is it friend? Is it teacher? Like, what is that dynamic?
Well, you know, that's a good question, Shannon, because, you know, it's so important for me to have, and the reason I'm hesitating is I'm trying to think of the right way to put this. I have a very interesting relationship with them, because obviously I'm the host of the show, and so I think that's quite daunting for them when they come in, and you're the person calling the shots, and Leroux and Henry, as you know, they're amazing. They've created such a wonderful platform where they hand over authority of the game to me when we're rolling, you know, and I think that transcends and gets through to the contestants, because you kind of have to have that, you know, from a safety element. If I say stop, everyone has to stop. If I say go, the same applies. And also within the game, and to keep the rules going, and to have a healthy respect for production through me, the host. Okay, so that's important to have. And so, you know, we create that environment for them. And what was really great on the last season is I was part of the casting process as well. So I got to know them in the casting process as well. And that's fantastic, because I was able to have a voice into, because having been involved with enough shows now, enough seasons now, you just understand organically how things work, and you have a feel for it. And so to be given a voice in terms of the casting as well, and you play an important part then when you get to the island, is that there's already a history there, there's already an understanding there, and you're looking at each of them and going, okay, I've met you before, you've been picked for a reason, I'm part of that process, but now let's see what you're going to do with what we've given you. And for me, it's really one of my favorite parts, of being the host, is I get to watch this show that I love and this journey. I mean, it's such an adventure. It's such a once in a lifetime adventure that these people are embarking on. It is really special. I mean, where else in your life do you get put into a situation like this, where you are literally surviving for your life? And this is as close as you get to a real survival situation without actually, you know, it being a life-threatening situation. You've got this incredible cast, this crew around you that's making it all possible. These amazing things every day is this incredible challenge that you have to overcome. You go on this physical journey, mental journey, spiritual journey. I mean, who doesn't want to be in that now? And then I get to see all of this play out in front of me. It's raw and it's real, unedited, in front of me. And, you know, a lot of the contestants will say this as well. What you see on screen is so true to what really plays out. Obviously, the edited version of there, but no one is misrepresented. I mean, that's as close as we can get to telling the real stories, you know. But even so, it is edited, and I'm there. I stand in front of them, and I make a point of every time when I'm standing on that mat, and I say, "Come on in, guys," and they come on in, and they stand in front of me. We've got a few moments where we just stand there. I just tell them to keep their eyes on me, looking in my direction, so we can get all our cameras lined up, get all our shots lined up, make sure everyone's standing not in front of one another, and we shift them around, and whilst that's happening, I look deep into every single one of their eyes. I mean, you can ask each one of them, and I'm not staring them down. I do just a moment where I just take in what's going on behind those eyes, and it's so beautiful for me to see, because I can literally see when they're switched on and when they're not, and it's so incredible, because in 5 seasons that I've hosted now, you start getting a feel for how people are and where they're at. And I start falling in love with these people. I really do. I sincerely start caring for them, you know. And yes, I'm sure the question pops up, do I have any favorites? Always, right from the get-go, but you'll never know about that. Mm-hmm. Neither will they. And I really start loving all of these people. And then to watch them go on this journey. And I remember, I am so, so envious of them. I would love to be one of them every single time. But of course, I'd also never give up the job of host, you know. So it's a good compromise. I'll take it. But there I am, and I watch them go on this journey. And almost every single one of them at some point reaches that point where they discover what they're truly about, you know, when all those layers get peeled away, you know. And I don't know how I mean, we've still got time. So really what for me is important is that these are everyday people thrust into this incredible situation, this very, very, they're under extreme duress, as I said, physically, mentally, psychologically. And then we start stripping away all these first world layers that we've all built up for ourselves, right? And when you start stripping away those layers, people start getting a glimpse into the true character beneath, okay? So we get a glimpse into their characters, and they get a glimpse into themselves, because, you know, we build these layers of protection around ourselves, but we don't realize that we also don't get to see in. And I think a lot of people come there to find themselves. You know, they come to play the game, but they also come to just see, how am I going to do? Because you really do not know until you're in this game how it's going to affect you. And I get to see that play out beautifully. And I've got to say, sadly, there's always two or three people that check out. They check out of the game. And sometimes they're people we did not expect it to happen to. But you don't know how you're going to react if you've gone for 3 days without food and with just water, and you're in this conflicted, you know, emotionally conflicted situation. And you've also got all this energy around you. And last night it was raining and it was cold, and you had to snuggle with someone who really doesn't smell good, and you don't like, but it's the only way to stay warm, you know. So we've got all of this going on, and then of course some people just can't hack it, and by day two you can see they're out of the game. But almost every single other person, at some point they get switched on, and every day I come and I stand and I look into their eyes and I see, okay, switched on, not yet, almost there, this one's there, okay, that one's there. And that just doing that, one can't help but just really start feeling empathy for them. I'm going to tell you something else. Can I go deeper into this?
Please do.
So this last season was crazy. I mean, we had terrible storms. The first couple of weeks was possibly the worst, you know, in terms of environment conditions in any of the seasons of South African Survivor we've done. It was cold at night and it was raining. It's sweltering heat in the day, and at night, cold and wet. And their shelters were terrible. I mean, they're terrible. Their shelters are horrible. I've even lain down on those bamboo reeds. It's the worst. I mean, it's horrible. And I come home after a long day in the sun. I'm tired. I'm sweaty. I can't wait to peel those clothes off me. My skin is raw from the sun and the wind and whatever. And I step into a hot shower, guys, and I stand under that water, and all of that weariness and that grime, it all washes away, you know. And I step out of the shower, I feel like a new man. And I tell you what, I always, while I'm in that shower, I pray for every single contestant on that island. Aww. Because I'm hearing the storm raging and I'm hearing the wind blowing, and I cannot imagine what it must like be like being in that situation. I've just seen them at tribal council. They are broken. You know, someone's just lost an alliance member. Everyone's just, it's just so raw. And here I am having a hot shower. And one can't help feeling guilty. And then the next day when you see them, you just want to give them all a hug, you know, but you obviously don't.
So, I mean, you could give them a hug if you wanted to ruin that shower, but
Exactly. Rub a little bit of body lotion on them.
Yeah. Whenever someone's voted out, you know, once I've killed the torch and they've done the walk of doom and they go off and they go and do an interview. And then when they come back, they don't know what to expect because they still expect the solemn energy, you know, when they come back. Because we do some photographs afterwards and kind of relive the whole snuffing of the torch moment, which is torture for them. But we have to have that thing later and that kind of thing. And so they don't know when they come back from their they've left tribal. They've just been voted out. Some of them are crying. Most of them are crying. They walk away. They're still in shock. They go for a one-on-one interview, and then they come back, and they're told by the chaperone, you've got to go back to tribal for another photograph. And you can imagine what's going through their mind. They're like, oh, geez, not again. And they walk back, and usually what we do is I rally all of the crew that is there at that moment, and as they come walking back up the walk of shame, we clap hands, and we just whoop, you know, and we celebrate them, and then the first thing I go up and I give them a hug, and they don't smell, and their hair is sticky, and you know, I give them the biggest hug I can, and just let them know, listen, I couldn't do this, but here it is now. You've done well. You're out now. Now we can love you. You know, we can give you some love. And I tell you, it's the most beautiful reaction always. Most of them, you know, tears come streaming down because they're feeling love for the first time. You know, every other hug they've gotten up until that point in the game from the contestants, you don't know if it's a real hug, right? But when the game's over and you're out, and then my assistant, she always brings, I always tell her to prep a chocolate or something, and then we give them some sugar, and we give them some salt in the form of crisps. It's the only thing we have at that moment, and they love that, you know. So anyway, I could carry on like this forever. Forgive me. I'm gonna keep quiet for a second. You guys go.
That's genuinely sweet, and like you are for most of them like the loved ones visit, you know. I feel like people get that hug when their family members come out to the island, but only a select few get to do that. So like you sort of serve as that representation of home. But speaking about your relationship with the contestants, I want to talk about Maldives, because Maldives is such an interesting situation where half the cast was made up of celebrities. So you bring up so many great points about watching humanity eke through these people the more time they spend on the island, and the more time, as you said, that switch turns on. But I can imagine how weird it was to have, you know, half the cast who, you know, you are in invariably the same industry as them, and watch them go through that process. Did you handle that season differently as a host, whether or not you knew the celebrities or you knew sort of like where they came from in terms of stature in the community?
No, you know what? Mike, you know, that's a good question in the sense that one of the things that's very important for me as host is to treat everyone exactly the same. And that's something I was always going to be very, very forceful about and try not to veer away from, because it's, you know, you've got to be that unbiased single voice, that one place where they're not being judged. They're being facilitated. They're being, they're being guided. But they're not being, no one's being pulled ahead of the other except for what they give in the game. All right. So what you bring in from outside, that doesn't matter to me. But if you perform in the game, I'm going to give you kudos. And if you don't, I'm going to give you a tough time for it, you know. And just before we go, you know, let me dip into the Maldives then. So I didn't care who they were. They were going to be treated equally. And it was very important that everyone had that understanding. And so I maintained that throughout. So no, absolutely. And I knew a few of them. Most of them I knew, you know. It was very interesting, but that only lasts for the first few moments. And when I say survivor's ready, and that's always so interesting to me, and I think it's the same for every host, around the world. People also, we often have media come in, and we let them play a day or two of the game, you know, and we let them try the challenges and just give them a sense of what it's about. I mean, we even at one stage we had them sleep over for a night on the island. I tell you, it was so entertaining. I mean, these people didn't know what hit them. So we had them come in and try the games, and then everyone's joking and they're all relaxed, and maybe they had a beer for breakfast, you know, and they're quite chilled. But let me tell you, when I say survivor's ready and I raise my hand, everyone switches on. And it's that whole deer in the headlights look. And you can just see people going into primal mode, you know, people you wouldn't have expected it from. And you know what the thing is we have to watch out for is when we do bring media in and visitors in to come and try one or two of the challenges, we actually have to warn them to just not go all out because you'll get hurt. We had people getting stitches.
We had,
So Nico, I actually went out as media for this most recent US Survivor season. Yes. And yeah, I was part of that. And I did get hurt. I went like adrenaline pumping and like cut off my legs. You know, my cohort who I was with got like a bruised rib. I tweaked my back while I was moving the puzzle pieces around. But to your point, like we completely forget our lack of athleticism in the moment when you know, as a Survivor fan, you understand too. You're like, oh yeah, I'm gonna kill this challenge, though it ended up killing me more so.
It's beautiful though, isn't it? I mean, you don't expect you're going to feel that way, right? I mean, you think you're just going to kind of go there and you're going to kind of, you know, you're going to feel it out. You're going to give about 70%, you're not going to jump over that thing, you know, you're not going to dive under that. You don't want to get completely covered in mud. But I tell you what, when the host says Survivor's ready, go. I mean, it's like something takes over and you just dive in there, you know, which is incredible. And I know we've got to get back to a few points, but you know, it's interesting. My wife was along, and she's been along on the last few with my kids as well. And you know, LaRue said, "Hey, Christy, don't you want to come? And, you know, do we test all the games? We don't have a full dream team like the US guys do, but we do have a crew and you know some members who come in and take part in the challenges because we rehearse each challenge the day before, make sure that it's as tough as possible without being impossible. We check for safety and all of that. So Christy, who's quite the competitive person to say the least, but also a very, very well kept, and she's a she's gorgeous. I love her. She's incredible. I've got an incredible wife. I have to say it. And she's just so beautiful and poised. She always looks lovely. But I tell you what, when she got in there, she was like, oh, I don't know if I should do it. Should I do it? I don't know if I should. I said, babe, you know what I mean? How often do you get a chance to go and test a game? Just go out and do it. You know. So it was quite an interesting moment. There I am. And there's my wife, and she's one of the tribes. We split them into two, and again, you know, I put my hand up. I said, "Survivor's ready," and my sweet, cute, gorgeous, very, very well kept wife just went into primal mode. Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, she got down and dirty, and she climbed through things. I didn't know she was capable of doing that. You know, I'm a very adventurous, outdoorsy kind of person, so I love being in the mountains and climbing over things, and I've got to kind of push to get her to join me. And when she does, she loves it. But I tell you what, when she got into that game, I mean, she just switched right on, and she climbed, and she still has, I don't know if we can always bleep this out later, but she still has splinters in her butt from sliding down one of those bamboo slides.
Poor woman.
And I'm so proud of her coming down that slide, and she was screaming and going crazy, and it was so beautiful to watch, you know. And yeah, I mean, you just can't help getting switched on. So, and just back to your point is, do I treat everyone the same way? When did you guys want to drop in with anything else? Because I want to say something about Letitia, but I'll say that later.
No, please. Listen, we don't know how much time she has left, Nico. So like, let's get some good words in about Letitia.
Well, Letitia was incredible. Here comes this older contestant, and you know, we knew that she physically she had the abilities, and she certainly had the mouth. I mean, if Survivor was a verbal game, she took the win all the way. You know, I mean, what you won't see on screen is you know, a lot of behind. I mean, she was giving it to me. She was really laying into me with every chance she got. But here comes this person, and I'm for me, I don't for me, it's all about when you come into this game, everyone's on an even keel. I don't care where you come from, what your background is, who you are, how athletic or not you are. You come into this game, if you are 70 and you decide you can play Survivor, you're going to play the game at the same level as everyone else. I'm not going to go softer on you because of your age, because then you're not playing the game, right? So once again, the mandate is I'm going to treat everyone exactly the same. And if you're lagging behind, if you're slowing your tribe down, I'm going to hustle you because you're lagging behind and you're slowing the tribe down. Don't throw age at me. Others have done better and they're older. Don't throw your weight at me. Don't throw your lack of athleticism at me. It doesn't wash. There is no excuse. Either you get in there and you get dirty, or you're going to get out. And so when Letitia came in, you know, that was going to be, I wasn't going to be any harder on her, but I wasn't going to be any softer on her. And I don't think she expected that, you know. And so for the first few episodes, I was really, really tough on her. And I know that she was laying into me on the islands, and certainly footage that you guys wouldn't have seen on screen. She was hating on me, you know. But I was secretly smiling behind, because I had so much respect for what she was doing, but I wasn't going to give her respect for being an older person and at least doing what the very least other person is doing on the show. I was going to give her acknowledgement when she rises above that and does exceptional things, which she then did. And it was so beautiful to see. And then when I was encouraging her, she, you know, and I could just see her lighting up. Not that she needed me to, because she's fired and powered by herself, Letitia, you know? And then to your question earlier on is, do I treat everyone equally? Absolutely. You know, it's so important for me to do that, but I can't wait. I can't wait to celebrate them when they do well. But I don't go lightly on them when they don't. And then something that's a real, real, it's the hugest pet hate of mine is, do not tell me you want to quit. Don't tell me that you want to leave the game, you know? Because that for me is such a disrespect to the game, to everyone who got you there, to everything about getting to that first day on the island and setting foot in this game that we've blood, sweat and tears to get prepared for you to set foot and play the most iconic game that most of us wish we could play. And then 2 days in, you say, no, this is not for me. I made a mistake. I'm out. And I think a few of us, in production feel the same way. So we make it as hard as possible for people to dip out.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this also comes down to production decisions you're making on the fly. Like, even as you say something in challenges, you're making the call on the spot. Do I call this person out? That might have social ramifications for them later in the game. And, you know, and it all works into it. So how do you approach the challenges with that in mind, of what your role is to play kind of in calling people out and narrating it to that extent?
Yeah. So before we have, as I say, what we do is what works really well, because in previous seasons, we would do our rehearsals for each game. And when I say rehearsals, I don't mean with the contestants. Let me be very clear on that. It's so important that people out there know. I'm sure most of your listeners know this. But for those who are new, who don't really understand how things work, Survivor is possibly the only reality show, I'd go as far as to say, that is more real than what we can show you on screen. You know, people always ask me, is it as bad? Is it as tough? Is it as crazy? And I always tell people, it is not. It's not as tough as you see on screen. It is way, way worse. We can't possibly convey to screen how rough it is to be a contestant on Survivor. It's crazy. I mean, listen, I went in and lay in their shelter. On the last season, we went to go and check do some recces whilst they were on a reward challenge. So we went to go and check their shelter. I'm trying to remember exactly what the context was, but I think that one of the tribes, one of the splits and the third tribe actually won the best shelter, and it was built by production for them. And they were going to come home to a roaring fire and to hammocks and a hanging bed. And so we went to make sure everything was in place, you know, and I went and I lay on, and now this is not a shelter they built themselves. I lay on a shelter that production, that our carpenters, the guys who know what they're doing, built. I lay down on those big, long bamboo poles, and they, I couldn't begin to imagine how you could sleep on that. It's Chinese torture, you know, those bamboo. I mean, it digs into your back, you know, and then, I mean, I'm one of those people who the mosquitoes flock to me. Apparently they love a certain type of blood. Okay. So I'm one of the, like every mosquito in Samoa would sit on me, and next to me, my wife would sit and she'd be smiling, and they wouldn't come near her. In fact, I would spray mosquito repellent on me, and those Samoan mosquitoes that actually look like little drones would come and drink. They'd come and drink the mosquito repellent. That's how bad they were. And I was covered in them. So imagine you're living in the shelter. And these insects are eating you. It is so rough. It's unimaginable. So I don't know how I digressed and where I went, but anyway. So when it came, oh yes, we were talking about rehearsing the games. Yeah. So we rehearsed the games. We used to rehearse the games on the same day, and then we'd go straight into playing the game afterwards. And we didn't always realize just how you know certain things that production needed more time. The art team and the carpentry team needed more time to fix things and that. And so. what we did this time is we had the rehearsals before on the day before, and on the next day we would then have the challenge, and that would give everyone enough time overnight, and our crew would work overnight to fix any issues we had, make things more difficult. And it's so amazing to see what those guys get up to. I mean, what they do in the span of 12 hours is mind-boggling, you know, but it's very necessary. And so when we get to the game the next day, what I've done is we've got a, you know, Leroux will hand me a kind of an outline of theoretically how the game should work and how the rules would work, and then I get onto set, and then I walk through all of that, and it takes a couple of hours to walk through it all, and we look at all the various things that can play out, what can go wrong, what can't, where are loopholes, where can, and how can we make it more difficult, what are things we haven't considered, because, you know, these games are all worked out months in advance on paper, but once it's built, a lot of the dynamic changes and little things are changed, and it's no longer a stick, it's now a ball, and you've got to change things that, and so I'll adapt the script to make sure that we've got that down, and then I'll also, when our dream team is playing things out, I'll look for things, for loopholes that people naturally take, and I look for issues that may come up, and I'll try and figure out what will work there. So that by the time we get to game time, when the contestants come on, they are switched on. And I think this is what I was trying to say earlier on, is nothing is rehearsed beforehand with our contestants. When they come in, they walk in, they stand on those mats, and when I say game on, it is game on. We've given them a quick off-screen briefing as to the rules and how things work, just so that they fully understand that. But when they play the game, it's the first time they play those challenges, and that's again why it's so great, is because there's no rehearsed element to Survivor. It's so organic and raw, and I think that plays out on screen. I think that's what people love the most. Can't always put their finger on it, but they know that something, this is so real, and I think that's what just draws us all in. I've gone all over the place with this one, Shannon, forgive me.
No, I love it.
I'm going to hold your feet to the fire for a second, Nico, a fire that production built for the winning reward tribe. So do you have a favorite season that you've been a part of, whether it was due to the location, whether it was due to the stuff that happened in the season, or just anything that, you know, the experience that you had? I know it's sort of like picking your favorite child, but what's the one that gives you the fondest memories looking back?
You're so right, Mike, because every season, I've loved every season, absolutely. But of course, there are certain things that stand out and make things different. And let's rather talk about it, you know, as a whole, because there are so many factors that go into each, you know, into each season of Survivor. One of the questions I get asked most is, oh, you guys, obviously, you live in these like 5-star hotels, and you have like you've helicopters flying in all over the place. And I'm like, no. I make that little joke about the fact that I get flown in and with an axe. And then I tell them, look, listen, we have the closest, most comfortable accommodation that can accommodate 150 to 200 people. We have a huge crew that comes with us from South Africa. We have a huge local crew, and our accommodation isn't always as fantastic as you'd imagine. But anything with a shower and an air conditioner and dry bedding is 5-star compared to what these guys have. Okay. So we've got that out of the way. So we live, obviously, that is going to be an element that appeals to one, is in how comfortable are we as crew? And I must say, I think Samoa was one of the most comfortable in terms of where we were as crew and how we were situated, and our proximity to tribal council, proximity to the various games and to tribal council as a set, you know, because a lot of what goes into what makes it really tough, what makes Survivor such a challenge, from a production point of view, is the logistics, the movement of people and equipment from place to place. And so in Samoa, we did a lot of travel by road, and it made things a lot easier, and tribal council was a lot closer. And so, you know, on the surface, you'd think that was a better season for us. And I'm going to concentrate on, let me also just say that Samoa and the Philippines, my favorite locations by far so far. Mm. The previous ones were lovely for various reasons. But I think possibly, you know, as a whole, the experience of the last 2 has been really incredible. Maybe that we've also reached an element of, you know, smoothly heavily oiled operation from every perspective. And so everything just moved a lot better. We were a lot closer between the two seasons playing out. So it almost felt like a back-to-back. And so you were still in the swing of things. I hadn't done a film in between or a TV series or hosted a travel show, or I was still in survivor mode when we came into the next one, you know. And so let's just stick to the last two as my favorite locations. And then Samoa is gorgeous. I mean, it is beautiful. It is this tropical paradise. It's so lush. I've never seen so much green. And I've been to Ireland. It's gorgeous. And Scotland is. And I was overwhelmed by the beautiful lushness of Ireland and Scotland. But I tell you what, Samoa is tropical paradise to a T. It's just incredible. And it's still very tribal. It's beautiful and it's untouched. It's unspoiled, I'd say. And so we stayed at I think I can say, yeah, the Sheraton. I think that's common knowledge now. It was really lovely. It was a beautiful location, swimming pool, massive pool. And so your home, your base camp was really awesome. And the scenery was awesome. But here's the problem I had with Samoa. Here's the big problem I had with Samoa is that we drove everywhere in land vehicles, most of the time. And the thing about Survivor that I love the most is being on the water. I love being on the water. I love going out in boats and trudging through tides, you know, when the tide is low and out, you stop your boats like 200 meters out away from the beach. And you've got to trudge back and you kind of, you know, you feel like you're part of it and you're working, you know, and in the Philippines, everywhere we went was mostly by boat, you know, and, you know, at first it's, you think, oh, geez, we've got to go on boats everywhere. And it's so, but after a while you miss, you know, I remember before tribal, it would be a good, let's say 45 minutes to an hour on the boat from our base camp to this beautiful tribal council setting that Val Groenewald built for us. You must remember that set. The tribal council from the Philippines. It was just gorgeous, beautifully lit up.
Oh, I mean, the giant dragon. Yeah, it's something I'll always remember.
Come on. You know, I did it. I've got a drone, so I flew a drone up and I did just a top-down shot. And I said to Val, did you plan this out? Look at the color of the roof that none of us ever saw while we were in it was exactly the color of the ocean at like sunset. You know, it was so beautifully thought out. She did such an incredible job. She always does. And anyway, so I would in that hour's drive to the island, it was so awesome because you watched the sunset over the water as you went, and it was just so romantic and beautiful. But I'm also centering myself and I'm going into tribal council mode where you've got to kind of drown out all the noise and people can't really talk on the boat because you know, you can't really, there's the wind is blowing and everyone's just trying to hold on, you know, often it's choppy making your way out. So you kind of in that, you zone in, and it was so great. It was a great prep, you know. And then sometimes coming back from tribal at night, I mean, we'd shoot until, you know, people don't realize the tribal council isn't 20 minutes as it is on screen or half an hour. It is sometimes it's up to 4 hours long, depending if storms come in, you know, and we've got to wait in the storms and sit there while we rain out. And it's a lot of that lands on the cutting room floor. So often coming back, storms would develop in the bay and then we would come back and it would be really hairy. I'm talking seriously hairy. In fact, there was one particular day where we were coming back, we knew that it could be hairy. We were told by the weather forecast, and we had the security guys and the medical guys coming in and saying, listen, it's a very small window. We've got to come back before this time. And if we don't, we could run into trouble. I mean, you've got a whole bunch of boats full of crew and then, of course, the cast, and it could get really ugly very quickly. But the call was made to do it because and not doing so would have even worse repercussions, because when would we have this tribal and things are worked out so tight. So we took the opportunity knowing that we'd break early. But of course, coming back at night, and these boat skippers, they're local guys. They skipper by sight, you know, so they don't always have this big spot going out. So they've got landmarks that they use, their skipper by sight. So on the way back, we're holding on to these rafts, these boats, for dear life. And we are bouncing up and down and people are flying all over the place. It's pitch black. You literally think that this might be the night that it all ends for you. And what a way to go, you know. I mean, imagine that epitaph. Died while coming from tribal council, drowned at sea in the Filipino Bay. You know, I mean, these people lived and died their passion. You know, okay, thank God that season's over and we made it safely back. Otherwise, I'd never say that. But the point is, it was so hairy. And I remember one time, at one point, LaRue and I looked at each other and there's a say, I think it's Jeffism. We may have come up with it, probably Jeff. I think, you know, everything's a Jeffism, but we look at each other and whenever things get really hairy and it's really hot or it's a heavy storm or we're trudging through like the most unbelievable circumstances, or we're sitting on a boat in the middle of the night with a raging storm, we look at each other and we shout, "This is why we came!" And we look at each other. And it was just this beautiful moment because we looked at each other and we just both blurted it out, you know, and nothing ever felt so good. You know, this is as close as we as production are going to get to being survivors, you know, in the game. And we loved it. I mean, LaRue and I, we were smiling. I mean, our smiles, our grins were cracking our faces. And of course, eventually we started just doing that whenever we had poignant moments in every season or in every situation after that, you know. So yeah, I mean, again, I think I've digressed from one topic to the next. Are we still on track?
We're like a boat in the middle of the ocean. You know, we're riding the waves. You're our skipper, Nico, and we're trusting your guidance.
Well, you know, we have a few questions from the listeners to get to, but I did also want to ask before we do, like, how do you see the way you've evolved as a host over several seasons of doing this and how you've grown? Do you see like some big differences from then to now?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think in the first couple I did, it was important to know that you're coming on as a host. And of course, the producers, they were also new to it. And so fairly new to it. And so they were also finding their feet. And so I think we were all kind of playing catch up, I think, with other seasons and especially the US season, trying to shoot close to the bar that was being set. But I think as we all, you know, evolved, you know, one starts getting a feel for it and you start owning it and surviving. Survivor South Africa, I think, started becoming my show as a host, so that when I stepped out then, and I want to attribute a lot of this to LaRue and to Henry, who included me. Even though I'm not a producer on the show, they brought me into a lot of those production discussions and brought me into the casting process, made me integrated me into that, so that I had a very organic understanding of where we were at and what we were doing. And with that comes a confidence, and with that comes you start feeling that a part of the show belongs to you as a host. And I think it's very important. I think I won't mention names, but someone came and asked me from one of the other shows, what advice would you give to new hosts? So what would you tell them is the most important part of, you know, to prepare them to become hosts? And I said, look, for me, what was really important and what really worked well for me in these last two seasons was being involved in everything and having an authority in the game. And what Henry has done, and he's given me an authority in the game to call the game, to you know. And of course, that came with having eventually knowing that they can trust me, knowing that I'm not just a host, but I'm a part of what makes Survivor South Africa Survivor South Africa, and that they trusted me with that. And so luckily we've grown together. You know now that Henry and LaRue and myself come a long way together, and we've grown, you know, together through the show and in various levels as it went. But for me as a host, I think a huge part of what makes you own the show is being involved with it, being involved with the casting process, having a say in that. And then also, you know, from the get-go, myself and LaRue, we love Survivor and we love the show so much. And and LaRue's always, I mean, you know, so LaRue's a super fan. You know that, right? I am not. I know he said I might be more of a fan. I wish I was a super fan like he was. He's just incredible. He's the most amazing human being, and he's such a super fan. And so I learn a lot from him, and he has so much excitement and telling me what the next thing he's done. And then, you know, I'll watch a US season and I'll send him a text and I'll say, oh, geez, look at this challenge. We've got to do this, you know, and when the next one we do, whenever we do it. And so there's that as well. You know, we're able to discuss what things that work and don't work. And so one becomes a part of the, you know, you become part of the organic structure of Survivor. And I think that's what you need as a host. When you walk out there, you're not just presenting a show. You're actually, people are coming into your turf and they're coming here to play. And if I make a call in a game, that call stands. I don't have to, consult with production and say, hey, you know, I made this call. I don't know, you know, should we veto that? It's I'm trusted enough. And when you have that confidence, you can walk out there and say, okay, guys, up until now, you know, there's a lot of involvement in that, but this is day one of 39 and you're now in my game and we're going to play it according to my rules, hashtag production rules, hashtag Henry's rules, but my rules, people, my rules, and I'm going to tell you if you don't. And I think if you go in with that, then I think that's what the contestants want as well. They want to know that someone's in control. I mean, they look to you for everything, so you better own it, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, speaking of LaRue, who's been, like, name-checked a lot on this podcast, rightly so, he's the first listener question I had. He asked, how do you feel about a host versus hero season? I would want to see Mike and Shannon host that season and you kick some serious butt. So now that you've hosted, has the dream of playing subsided, or is that still something that you would want to do one day?
Oh, Shannon, I'm so glad you asked. This is the question I've been waiting for. Okay, this is the big one for me. So here's the thing. If you speak to Rulugun, when you speak to him again, ask him who came up with the even just the name Heroes versus Hosts or Hosts versus Heroes, because that's mine. I coined it. And I said to Leroux, brother, listen to me. The only way I'm ever going to get to play is if all the hosts get pitted against all the heroes, you know. And I said to him, one day. I mean, can you imagine me and Jeff on a team? I'd love to play with Jeff, you know, or with Matt or with any of the others. I mean, I can imagine how much fun that would be, because I think the game has evolved to such a degree that it doesn't matter that you've got insight from behind the scenes. You know, people are coming with all kinds of insight from studying gameplay, you know, like from being super fans, or, you know, people who've played the game before. So it doesn't matter what your background is anymore. I'm not too famous to play the game of Survivor anymore, you know. So if ever the opportunity came along, you bet I would grab it with both hands, and I'd love to play that. So Albie, yes, absolutely, I would dip into that at any chance I get. And I think the question would be, who would host that?
Saying me and Mike, and we accept. So
yeah, so that's the thing, okay. Nico, what you don't realize is this was an entire interview for us to understand what a host does, so that Shannon and I can now pick up that ball and run with it.
Oh geez, okay, so we're gonna have to have a huge offline discussion then.
Yeah,
afterwards.
let's have coffee, let's sit down, and just like you had with Mark, let's pass the buck here.
Yeah. Okay. And you guys know you get dropped off, you know, you have to skydive in on the first one. So that's already a good start. So if you can do, practice that so long. And of course, making fire without flint, guys, you got to rub sticks together or stones, sticks or stones, you know, and that's the only way that the host does it. We don't use flint. I mean, that's for modern survivors.
I will not be hugging the dirty contestants. I'll just say that from the get-go. But the other stuff I think I'll do. But speaking of this, like, tribe of hosts, Jake M. Larson asks, do the hosts of the different International Survivor franchises ever talk to each other? Have you spoken to Jonathan LaPaglia, Matt Chisholm, Jeff himself? Has there been any cross-communication there?
I have not. And I think it's because, I don't think we've had the opportunity to do so. Certainly we don't hit each other up on Twitter and say, hey, how's it going? How's your seat? We don't. But I think if we ever did have the opportunity, we'd find so much to talk about. I think it's such an honorary position to be the host of such an iconic show. And I think we'd all love to sit around a campfire with Jeff, or perhaps in a bar and not around a campfire, because you don't want to feel like you're sitting at tribal council as a host, but be, you know, sitting there with Jeff. It would just be too weird. And I'd like want to put a buff on my head or something. But I think we'd get along really well. You know, I hate to say that I have not been able to watch any full seasons of Aussie or New Zealand. I'm only quite familiar with Jeff as host. I have seen snippets of their work, and I think they do sterling jobs. I think what's really great, and hopefully you guys would agree, is that everyone brings their own something. You know, no one tries to emulate Jeff, which I think would be a huge mistake. And I think everyone brings their own something which is so great and so necessary. And also you need to speak to your culture and your country. And I think everyone does that really well. Have Jeff and I met? No, but I did send him a cap, one of my Survivor host caps, signed, just thanking him for setting the bar, you know, and for us to be able to follow in his footsteps and, you know, just saying hi. And then he sent me one back. You know, saying, great, you're doing a great job, whatever. And but what was really interesting,
I love
about
that you and Jeff are just talking like exclusively through caps. That's amazing. Like, that's so Survivor.
Hatch. I love it.
It's how hosts communicate. It's cap speak. You know, it's a very, very evolved. You know, we don't have to say much. We know. And you can tell by the fingerprints on the hat if it was used or not. And you can tell by the base, if there's base powder in the band of the hat. then you know it's real. And if there isn't, then you know, just a fresh hat out of the box. So anyway, the freaky thing is Jeff's hat comes back with his little message and our handwriting, and I've got a really freaky handwriting. I mean, I've never seen anyone's handwriting that looks like mine. I don't think it's very pretty. My wife says, you know, she likes it. It's kind of arty or whatever. But Jeff's handwriting and mine, is it's the same that my wife asked me if I'd written a note from Jeff to myself, which is obviously, you know, quite insulting. But the point is, that is weird. That's a little weird, you know, that your handwriting is. So I'd like to see what Matt and the other's handwriting looks like so that we can just, maybe there's like this thing, like hosts all write the same. Maybe there's like this thread that no one knows about and we can unpack that, you know.
Send them a hat, like a global network of hats. Love it.
And then that's the great thing about the Host versus Hero season, though, is that, you know, you can't tell who voted for who because you all have the same handwriting on your votes.
And all the votes will be written on hats.
Yeah, Mike, that's what's great about you. You're already unpacking that and looking for the delicious elements.
I see you, Nico. You're making those pregame alliances, saying all the hosts are so great. Like, I totally see this happening. But another question, we had Abraham Eric Lopez asking, Jeff is well known to hate it when contestants try to give him non-answers or avoid questions at Tribal Council. So how do you deal with these type of players? If they're kind of evading you and not giving you your content that you need, what are you doing to kind of get that out of them?
Yeah, you know, and that's what happens at every tribal council. I mean, there's this dance that takes place at every tribal council, is that people are, they're trying to keep their cards close to their chest. They know they have to answer my questions, you know, but they're worried that they do, that I might dip in there and ask them, oh, really? So who's the other person you're mentioning? And then they've got to dig into that and they didn't want to go there. And so people come into tribal and I really have to spend the first while kind of disarming them and kind of, you know, as I've said before, looking for those expressions when I go, you know, Werner, you had an interesting reaction to that. And Werner, for example, he's a great example of like that poker face from, he's Werner from the Philippine season. He had this poker face and he'd, you know, I'd ask him a question and he'd go, Nico, when it comes to Survivor, and then I'm looking at him and I'm going, really, Werner, are we going to do this again? You know, and he knows what he's doing and I know what he's doing and he knows I know what he's doing. And so some people are tougher than others, you know, and I've heard that Jeff may stop things and say, you know, okay, guys, listen, you got to give me this, you got to give me that, you got to give me that. I think that honor lies with Henry to do, and he doesn't take that approach. Henry's a lot more, you know, from an executive producer's point of view. He is such an incredible leader. I mean, Henry is like the Rob of production, okay? And he's got this very cool, quiet calmness about him. I call it quiet power. It's what I loved about Rob's gameplay as well, and I'd love to chat about that later if we have time. But He that's how he runs his whole tribe of crew, you know, and this whole production of Survivor is he's very quiet and he's very firm. And if you're not pulling it, he comes to you and he says to you very firmly, listen, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. And I think I adopt that same kind of approach in tribal as well, because, you know, like I said, once tribal happens, I may have Henry in my ear for cues and things, and he may pop a question here or there, but we've already had our pre-discussions where we wanted to go, and he trusts me with tribal to run with it and to go organically, because there's no time to listen to someone talking in your ear. You want to keep the flow going. You don't want to let any of the beats drop, and you want to stay in. And if someone's slowly loosening up, you want to stay in on that. And so my approach to when people aren't opening up is to just keep going and dancing around them. We can edit all of that out. But when I crack you, that's the part we're going to keep. So the sooner you get there, the better for you. And I think after a while, they start realizing it, you know. I think it's an interesting thing at Tribal is to just start reading the tells. It's such a beautiful thing. You know, my training as an actor maybe helps me look at that in a different way, because you look at the nuance, you look at between the lines, you look at not at what's being said, but what's being emoted, what's being telegraphed by little tells that people have. And so I'm so focused at tribal. I mean, I look like I'm just sitting there listening, but I'm so deeply. I'm soaking in what the person that's talking is telling me. I'm trying to soak in what the reactions are, because I've got to go to this person and that person afterwards and try and you know, they think they're keeping a poker face, but they don't realize I see everything that's going on. And then I've got my jury on the side here on the left-hand side. And then in my ear, I've got cues going on. So I'm really focusing in. And so I find it so exhilarating because, that's my opportunity for being switched on and really just becoming almost a little primal from my side and just really listening to what's going on and then playing around with what I get. So to answer your questions, no. I don't, but I do call them out. And sometimes that makes it on screen. But I'll say to them, listen, guys, you've got to answer this question. I'm not asking you something strange. I'm not asking you something. This is very pertinent to your game. And people will often come with weird arguments that I say, well, listen, that makes no sense at all. Do you understand fundamentally what's happening right now? But further than that, I don't tend to go no.
Well, this is just, there's so much insight. I feel like we could just talk about this for days. But Nico, we appreciate so much you coming on and giving us just so much intel into the back end of Survivor South Africa and your approach to it. And it's just really an honor to have you on the podcast.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be on here. And like I say, I love what you guys are doing. And what's happened with Survivor is it's no longer this adventure that people just enter and hopefully they'll do okay, but it'll be such a great adventure. For Survivor has become a phenomenon, a worldwide phenomenon. It's a game that gets played and you come in there and you're pitting yourself not only against the elements and against what production throws at you and against one another, but you're pitting yourself against the game, holistically of Survivor and games and all players that have come before you. I mean, we see someone like Rob, who's just played this last game of Survivor, this last season, and he's catapulted into Survivor stardom worldwide, I think, because of this incredible game that he played and this is the same of contestants around the world. Anyone can kind of rise up because now you're not just playing the game of Survivor of your own country. You're playing the worldwide phenomenon. And I think that's so exciting for us. And people like you and platforms like yours give people insight into that. You unpack it in a way that people can understand and can start seeing, listen, there is a lot more that goes into this than just not eating and getting a six pack after 39 days. It's so beautiful what you do. So thank you and keep going.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I want to ask one quick favor, just because a good friend of mine and fellow Survivor media person, Josh Wigler, loves the way that you epically say like the season names at the very, beginning of the season. So for his sake, can we just get like one big epic Nico Panaggio, Survivor South Africa Philippines or Survivor South Africa Island of Secrets, just so we can take ourselves back to those epic moments when you're standing on the bluffs?
Okay, so I think in American it's Survivor, but in South Africa it's Survivor. Welcome to Survivor. Previously on Survivor. Survivor SA Philippines. So, and of course, we've got the SA on the end, so we had to try and make that work. So you can imagine me going, Survivor SA. Survivor SA eventually just comes out the way it comes out. So Survivor SA, welcome to Survivor SA. This is Survivor SA Philippines or Survivor SA Island of Secrets. And that's one thing I think about whenever they tell me the new name. I'm like, how does that ring? Why can I make that ring? Because, eventually that becomes ingrained in one's mind. And it can drive you wild. Or it could be like, I really like the sound of that. Survivor SA Philippines. And I think you also want to feel like you want to go there, right? So you want to kind of just, it's got to feel and taste delicious on the lips, right? So yeah, I'll keep trying.
It's honestly surreal hearing you say it. And then it's like, yeah. I've heard that so many times, but you're doing it for me live right now.
Well, you know what I found, what people were calling me out on, a couple of people came up to me and said, so one of the things that stands out for them, and this is something my wife laughs about all the time, and my kids, my two kids and my wife are also fans, by the way. And that's the other thing is I take them along with me because I can't be away from them for so long. And it's so incredible to have them there. And they love the show. We take them onto set and they get buffs and LaRue gives them a buff each. And I'm talking about my wife as well. She's just as excited. And the kids love it, of course. And so the one thing they always laugh at is when it's a neck on neck challenge and it's a tribe against tribe and they're coming close and Lamai thinks they have it. Lamai thinks they have it.
And they do.
They do.
I totally
everywhere
do.
I go. Past me going, they do. And of course, you don't realize how bad it sounds until you see the playback. And well, somehow it's stuck. So it's going to be there for a while.
I like it. It's like your new Nico Nugget. That's what we used to call it, right, Mike?
The Nico Nuggets.
There's one.
Yeah, well, guys, you should all follow Nico at Nico Panaggio on Instagram and Twitter. I mean, it's so amazing that you're interacting with the fans like this. And you can always follow me at Shannon Gates, Mike at A Mike Bloom Type. The hashtag, I feel like, has to be Hat Chat. I'm obsessed with this global network of hosts communicating entirely in hats. Like, it's completely perfect.
Yeah. Either that or hashtag, this is why we came here.
This is why we came. I think some of the other hosts may have met Jeff, so they're going to have to step back and just go into a head chat, because it's the host thing now. You know, it's the way we communicate. So, yeah.
It sounds like the joke answer to, like, how do all, you know, Survivor hosts communicate? It's like entirely in hats, but it's actually true. It's perfect. But Nico, we're so appreciative that you came on to chat here. We are still talking about Survivor South Africa. It ended so long ago, but we will never give it up. So make sure you guys, if you're subscribed to the International Survivor or Wrap-Ups feed, the Reality TV or Wrap-Ups feed, the Survivor Island of the Idols RHAP feed, where all of me and Mike's work is happening, all of our Survivor content. But Nico, until then, thank you so much. And I hope we get to chat again about all the amazing things that you're doing, you know, and on Survivor South Africa, if not when, it's going to happen. We can't wait to watch you hosting again soon.
Amen.
Yeah, it's definitely a when and not if.
Wait, did I say if not when? No, it's when, not if. It's very late here in Australia. It's happening.
Exactly. It's happening. It's happening. And you guys will be the first to know when it does. I'll definitely pop in for another visit. Bless you guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nico. And thank you to Mike as well. Thanks to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes, as always. And we will chat with you next time on the inevitable next Survivor South Africa podcast. Bye.
Australian Survivor.
Survivor New Zealand.
Survivor.
Survivor.
21 South Africans.
12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
British middle.
Swamalas.
£1 million.
Million euro.
Million
shekel.
1 million rubli.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.